Good morning and welcome to the Resistance Roundtable, our monthly show, which comes to you on the second Saturday and where we assess some of the political developments of the past couple of weeks. My name is Richard Hill, and I'm here with our regular panel, Ruth Ann Baumgartner and Scott Harris. And today we'll be joined by a special guest on the phone, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange and Code Pink, who will comment on the crisis in Venezuela, the effect of U.S. sanctions and the threats from the Trump administration and a bevy of neoconservatives to pursue a policy of regime change. We'll also encourage listeners to call in during the second half of the show with comments or questions. Our on-air number is 203-336-9756. But let's get started with some comments from our panel, giving their perspective on some of the issues they've been grappling with this past couple of weeks. Ruth Ann, what do you got on the slate?
I have two. I want to start with the news out of Virginia. And a question, can we now expect Donald Trump and Brett Kavanaugh to resign, having been the subjects of several credible accusations of sexual assault? I would like all politicians to be held to the same standards. And as I watch the Virginia situation, I am shown once again that they are not. Do we waive the importance of sexual misconduct or sophomoric displays of racial bigotry and historical ignorance for Republicans if we have become principled enough to insist on it for Democrats? And the second is a larger and longer term, I hope, issue. Television and various other media, the 2020 gossip has begun, plus some very interesting conversations that may take air away from other coverage, such as the discussion on last week's WPKN broadcast of First Voices Radio of Elizabeth Warren's claim to Native American ancestry. I've been thinking about that ever since, meditating on the whole question of the construct of identity. But partly because I'm fascinated by such issues, I worry that as issue after issue emerges, we're headed into the same media circus and clown car coverage we've seen in other election cycles in the last 30 years or so, maybe beginning with the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs of the Republican primaries in '88. I believe in a free press, but I also believe the reason that freedom has protected status in the First Amendment to the Constitution is that a democracy cannot function with an uninformed electorate. Trustworthy information of all kinds is essential to responsible decision-making. So I wonder how concerned citizens can get that from the media in the current age. I find myself echoing the words of the disappointed Republican candidates of 2016 that the voters will be denied access to important information on issues and policies that are of genuine importance to their lives, that ought to affect their votes, as the media follow the latest tweets, scandals, spats, and stats.
Yeah, I worry about that too, Ruth. And I wonder if this whole issue, this whole problem that you're delineating there, could be eliminated if, as in other countries that are regarded as democracies on the planet, the election season was limited to 2 months instead of 2 years.
Oh, that would help a lot, I think.
So it's in order to keep the entertainment value alive for 2 years, you have to get silly, you know, and you have to get just superficial, and you have to focus on things that basically entertain as opposed to inform.
Well, so it's gotten like the coverage of the Super Bowl. You know, you start as soon as the football season begins and you start to speculate about this team and that team and this player who got ejected because he's having a sexual whatever and this other player who may have a broken thumb and this one who may be traded or does. And they talk about that and talk about that and talk, will they make the Super Bowl? They've had one win so far. And I think the elections are covered very much like that.
That is excellent. Well put. Scott, what have you been thinking about this past couple of weeks?
Well, our topic that we're going to be discussing later this morning with Medea Benjamin is the Trump administration's intervention in the political and economic crisis in Venezuela. And so I've been thinking about legitimacy in terms of governments and democracy. And, of course, the United States has an extremely long history of military interventions and covert coup d'etats, as well as being in bed with any number of authoritarian dictatorships and horrendously brutal governments all across the world. And while Trump is attacking frontally Venezuela now, and that's certainly started back in 2002 when they tried to launch an unsuccessful coup against Hugo Chavez back in that year. The fact is the United States is in bed with any number right now as we speak of horrendous governments in Saudi Arabia, North Korea, you know, where all these compliments going back and forth between Trump and Kim Jong-un, one of the most brutal dictators in the world today. And the Philippines, Duterte there in his drug war that's killed tens of thousands. And Turkey is Erdogan and Honduras, where we overthrew a government under Obama. And that included Hillary Clinton, of course, being the head of the State Department. And, you know, I was just thinking about what is a legitimate democracy in the context of what's going on now in Venezuela. And here in the United States, of course, we have a president who wasn't elected by the majority of the people. We have a president who lost the election by 3 million votes to Hillary Clinton. That happened again in 2000 with Al Gore losing to George W. Bush, despite the fact that Gore won by 500,000 votes. There's something called the Electoral College that was put in place by the slave states during the founding of this country. And so we're not a democracy. How does the candidate with the least number of votes win the election? I mean, if any other nation had pulled that off, we would call it illegitimate. We're living in an illegitimate democracy. And you add to that disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of voters with these extremely bogus ID laws, curtailing early voting, setting up obstacles for registrations of new voters, closing polling places and limiting voting machines to create untenable long lines so people will give up and not vote, massive voter purges, the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act of 1965, partisan and racial gerrymandering, ensuring during this current era, the Republican Party has a lock, although that lock was broken only because of a massive turnout. And it certainly doesn't ensure democracy for the future in terms of House of Representative votes going forward. So just to conclude here during this rant, I found this article that I came back to it. Actually, I'd seen it earlier when it was first published in March 2018 in the Atlantic magazine. The title of it is America is Not a Democracy, How the U.S. Lost the Faith of Its Citizens and What It Can Do to Win Them Back. And if I can, I'll just read a short quote from this, because I think this gets to the bottom line of democracy or not a democracy. So this is the Atlantic article. The subversion of the people's preferences in our supposedly democratic system was explored in 2014 in a study there by the political scientists Martin Gillens of Princeton and Benjamin Page of Northwestern University. Four broad theories have long sought to answer a fundamental question about our government. Who rules? One theory, the one we teach our children in civic classes, holds that the views of average people are decisive. Another theory suggests that mass-based interest groups such as the AARP have the power. A third theory predicts that business groups such as the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of America and the National Beer Wholesalers Association carry the day. A fourth theory holds that policy reflects the views of the economic elite. Gillens and Page tested those theories by tracking how well the preferences of various groups predicted the way that Congress and the executive branch would act on more than 1,700 policy issues over a span of 20 years. The results were shocking. Economic elites and narrow interest groups were very influential. They succeeded in getting their favored policies adopted about half the time and in stopping legislation to which they were opposed nearly all of the time. Mass-based interest groups, meanwhile, had little effect on public policy. As for the views of ordinary citizens, they had virtually no independent effect at all. When the preferences of economic elites and the stands of organized interest groups are controlled for, the preferences of the average American, appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. That was the conclusion of this study. And I think we've lived that all of our lives, all of us in the studio and all of us listening. And democracy in America is kabuki theater. It's phony. It's a sham. And yet this country, you know, strides broadly onto the world stage saying we're the beacon of democracy, and the little guy has his say. It's just so much junk. It makes me angry, especially in the context of attacking Venezuela. With all the faults and flaws and scandals and corruption in Venezuela, you know, this country has no right to be intervening there.
Well said, Scott. And actually, one thing I will say, one caveat to what you said, is that in this past election and previous ones and probably future ones, there's been this trend to have a petition drives to get issues on the ballot to actually create policy change from the grassroots. And to some degree, they were successful in this past election with recreational marijuana laws passed and also, I think, Medicaid expansion mandated by voters, not to mention the felon reenfranchisement in Florida. I'm not sure if that was also the case in Virginia or whether that was just a executive order from the governor. But so this is what's being resorted to by the population now, who is wising up to the very thing that you're saying. Citizens are realizing that if they want to actually have an effect on the structures of government in which they live, they actually have to create them right at the grassroots and get them onto ballots and get a majority vote on them. Now, we know that some of these things are being countered by poison pills put in place by Republican legislators in the interregnum before the new administrations take place, or in cases where Republicans control the state. For example, they tried to slow down the felon reenfranchisement thing in Florida, and who knows how that will actually play out. But still, citizen action is really proving to be a potent force to counter this kind of lack of democracy that we
and
have.
If I could just follow up, I know Ruth Ann wants to say something here, but we can go to the states of Wisconsin and was it North Carolina and Michigan, where the Republican legislator tried to take away essential powers from the new Democratic governor was elected. In those cases, just trumping the people's will. It's another example. But as you said, Richard, I mean, there's hope in terms of some of those grassroots movements that are trying to tackle the problem of the lack of democracy.
Yeah. Well, the frustrating thing is that those movements take so long to accrue energy and then focus the energy and then work their way through the barriers and around the little potential pitfalls and get the legislation in a position where it can even be considered. And meanwhile, every day the guy in the White House is signing another executive order undoing what has been standard practice for decades, or what just was achieved last year or in the last administration, and undoing things that we've been taking for granted as settled. So if we want to make a change, it takes years of organizing and pressure, and that change can be undone by new little legislation or an executive order putting something in place or taking something away in minutes. And all those take is a phone call to the golden phone. And there you go. Not to be too discouraging.
Well, as we get ready for our conversation with Medea Benjamin, which will be coming up in a couple of minutes, let me just mention that this last Thursday, we saw the outdooring of the Green New Deal in the form of a resolution presented by Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of Queens, New York, or Bronx, New York, actually. And the proposal already has many congressional co-sponsors, as well as support from several of the declared Democratic presidential candidates, including Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, and probably a couple others. So in the light of that, much is being made of Speaker Nancy Pelosi's reaction on Wednesday when she was asked about the Green New Deal in an interview with Politico. Pelosi said, and I'm quoting, "It will be one of several or many suggestions that we receive. The Green Dream, or whatever they call it, nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right?" Totally waving it away as some kind of sophomoric effort by the freshman class. So meanwhile, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has declined to serve on the Select Climate Panel, possibly because it was effectively defanged by Pelosi, who denied it subpoena power and the ability to send legislation directly to the House for consideration, nor is it explicitly charged with creating Green New Deal legislation. So I guess my point here is that it seems the lines are being drawn between the new class of progressive Democrats and the old guard represented by Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. And the question is, who is going to win this tug of war to pull the party toward the left or back to the comfortable corporate center? And given the strong polling in favor of virtually every concrete proposal contained in the Green New Deal, and these data come were presented in an interview on Scott Harris's Counterpoint show this week with Dr. Anthony Lycerowitz, it's hard to see how Democrats can ignore the powerful progressive current flowing through their party and the nation. And that interview was very interesting, Scott, because Dr. Lycerowitz, he listed virtually every proposal contained in the overarching Green New Deal. And when they were individually polled, between 70 and 90% of not just Democrats or independents, but Republicans supported them in principle and thought they would be a good idea. So it would seem the time has come for these ideas. And if the Democratic Party isn't going to make them part of their platform, where do these people go? Where do 90% of the people go, as you were saying before, in a democracy that is often fails the popular will?
Well, we'd like to welcome Medea Benjamin to the program right now. Medea is a longtime peace and social justice activist and organizer. She's co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. She's also the author of several books, including the latest Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection, and Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Medea's recent Common Dreams article, co-written with Nicholas Davies, is titled Venezuela, the U.S.'s 68th Regime Change Disaster, which argues against U.S. intervention in Venezuela's political and economic crisis, while urging an end to sanctions and support for a diplomatic resolution of the oil-rich nation's internal conflicts. Medea is a frequent guest on many of our programs here on WPKN and a good friend of the station and community radio across the U.S. Medea, thanks for joining us this morning.
Nice to be on. Thanks for having me.
And Medea, maybe I can just start our discussion about Venezuela by asking you to comment on the threat of military intervention in tandem with the economic, the very devastating economic sanctions that have been targeting Venezuela's oil industry and their bulk of their income for the country.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that, aside from the 2009 coup in Honduras, most of us have just read about in history books, from the 53 overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala, the 73 one in Chile. This is happening in real time now, and it's important to see through the narrative of the mainstream media and the bulk of the views we're getting on Venezuela in the international press, and recognize this for what it is. The U.S. wanted to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution that started with the election of Hugo Chavez. Since the time that it started in 1998, it supported the coup against him in 2002, and it will only be in later years that we'll read about what I'm sure is a whole grab bag of dirty tricks that the CIA and other U.S. institutions have been doing over these years to try to sabotage this Bolivarian Revolution and make sure there was no good model of socialism. That doesn't excuse all the problems, the corruption, the gross mismanagement, and all kinds of other things that the government of Venezuela has done. But this is, in essence, a classic case of a coup orchestrated from Washington.
This is Richard speaking. I wonder if maybe you could talk a little bit more about some of the things that are being left out of the mainstream media's coverage of Venezuela. And I'm speaking specifically about context. Who was Hugo Chavez? What did he do? What was some of the accomplishments that he achieved to establish a real strong popular base in Venezuela and leading up to his demise and passing the torch to Nicolas Maduro.
Yeah, I had the privilege of going to Venezuela several times and then seeing Venezuela in the context of the Latin America pink tide that was taking over and putting progressive governments in power. And I remember thinking, with all the problems in the Middle East, the silver lining was that the U.S. was distracted and Latin America could chart its own course. That has totally given way to a wave of conservative, reactionary governments in Latin America and much more direct U.S. intervention with John Bolton calling the troika of tyranny Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. And you ask what was the context under Hugo Chavez. The times that I had been there, I was totally blown away by all of these social programs that were redistributing land to indigenous people, that were giving opportunity for high school and even college education for people who never had a chance to study, eliminated illiteracy in the country, provided health care, and when Venezuelan doctors refused to go into the countryside, brought in thousands of Cuban doctors to go out in the countryside and the poor barrios to be giving free health care to people. So there were massive civil programs, social programs that led to a tremendous increase in the standard of living of the poorest people in Venezuela. And that's why even to this day, there's still a remainder of maybe 20 to 25% of people who still have support for the Bolivarian Revolution and want to see it continue its course or want to see it have a much fairer chance to provide or correct a lot of the mistakes that have been made. But the context is one of people during the time of Chavez getting a much, much better standard of living. We also have to recognize that perhaps the biggest problem for the Venezuelan economy right after the death of Chavez was the dramatic fall in the price of oil, which sliced the budget of Venezuela by more than 50%. And in the meantime, you had all these social programs that the government wanted to continue, and that was just a recipe for disaster.
Medea, I did want to ask you about a couple of personnel that are front and center in the Trump administration policy towards Venezuela right now. And one you mentioned earlier, John Bolton, a neocon, one of the neocon architects of the disastrous Iraq War under George W. Bush. And more recently, they brought along Elliot Abrams, who has a long history of intervention, especially in Central America during the 80s, during the dirty wars of the United States, the Reagan-Bush administration there, with the Contra War against Nicaragua and support for death squads in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. Maybe you could speak a bit about Elliot Abrams, his role in the past, and what his role, in your view, will be now that he's been assigned as the U.S. envoy to the Venezuela crisis.
Yeah, I mean, let me first make a comment about John Bolton, because we were at his house the other day with an indictment. And not only were we talking about his role today in Venezuela, where he is really the one that has the power because he is much more senior than Elliot Abrams. And I think he's the one that is plotting step by step this coup that we're seeing. We also talked about his role in Iraq, but also in Israel, where he has been a strong supporter of the apartheid policies of the extremist government of Netanyahu. And he has been supporter of the transfer of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. He has been a supporter of the settlements. And And then we talked about him on Iran, and Iran is very important because it's a mirror image in some ways of what's going on in Venezuela. But there, Bolton has really promoted the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and is a great supporter of this terrorist organization, the MEK, that he thinks could be a legitimate group to take over in Venezuela, in Iran, which mirrors some of the very repressive and violent groups on the right in Venezuela that Bolton has been supporting. And then you talk about Elliot Abrams. Well, he has the history in the region where his hands are full of blood from supporting Rios Montt in Guatemala that led to the massacre of so many Guatemalans, to his support for the Contras in Nicaragua, which, of course, makes him want to take out revenge against the government right now in Nicaragua, his support for the coup in Honduras in 2009, his support for the Venezuelan coup against Chavez in 2002. So he is known as a conniving, immoral militarist who has been brought in to help John Bolton orchestrate this coup.
Medea, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the precipitous decline in oil prices, which devastated the Venezuelan economy to the point of actually bringing it to its knees when Maduro took over. But talk, if you would, about the sanctions that have been imposed since Trump came to power, but also maybe give us an update or a little bit of insight into whether there were sanctions imposed by the Obama administration on the Venezuelan economy.
Yes, there were sanctions imposed by the Obama administration, but they were mostly on individuals. I think they pale in comparison to the sanctions starting in 2017. You see this incredible strangling of an economy that was already in free fall, making it extremely difficult for Venezuela to make transactions using dollars, to have access to international finance, to finance its debt, and making it very difficult for businesses in Venezuela to do business on the international market, and now seizing the assets of Venezuela in the United States, billions of dollars in just Citgo alone, and encouraging other countries, like in the UK, to freeze the assets in gold that the Venezuelan government has.
I wanted to go to the arguments made in favor of U.S. intervention here, Medea. There are many people from Venezuela, 3 million people have left the country, due largely in part to the economic crisis there. But, you know, as you've acknowledged, there's a lot of opposition to Maduro and the way he's handled politics and the economics of the situation there. And opponents of Maduro claim he's an authoritarian. He's locked opponents up in prison. He's clamped down on freedom of the press, and that U.S. intervention is the only way they're going to get this guy out of power. And so there are people in Venezuela, of course, we know, who are welcome U.S. intervention. What is the way out of this conundrum without going to the specter of U.S. military intervention or this wholesale destruction of the Venezuelan economy, which affects everyone, opponents and supporters of Maduro alike?
Well, let's also recognize that the specter is not only of U.S. intervention, it's of civil war. And if there were 6 million people who voted for Maduro, and now he claims that there's 10 million who signed up against U.S. intervention. Who knows how much of that is real, but there's got to be millions. In fact, you know, we know that there are many people who have been critics of the Maduro regime who now are going to be faced with, do they support Yankee intervention, which is something that most people in Latin America remember with horror. So the way that the opposition with the U.S. really, I think, calling the shots is trying to divide the military and peel off sectors of the military is something that could lead to civil war. You see them right now using humanitarian aid as a weapon, trying to get the civilian population to overwhelm the military that is stopping the aid from coming in because the Maduro government sees it as a Trojan horse, and perhaps wanting the troops to fire on innocent people as they're just trying to get some food and medicines, which would just totally set off an absolute crisis and probably military against military. So the dangers can't be overstated right now. And I think we have to recognize that without showing that there is another side to this, that there are people who support the Maduro government, that there is call for a negotiated solution, and that the governments of Mexico and Uruguay and the Vatican and even the Secretary General of the UN have put themselves forward to mediate, this is something that the U.S. government should be supporting. And since we know who's in the Trump administration, they're not going to do it, we have to look to Congress to do that. Unfortunately, they are not doing it at all. And in fact, I was shocked yesterday to see a statement by Nancy Pelosi saying she recognizes Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela. We should all be calling in and writing, and I know our Code Pink colleagues in San Francisco last night when they heard the statement went out to our house to say, how could you possibly be doing this, and don't you know where this is leading? So we need to get some opposition from members of our Congress.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually, Medea. The response of Democratic politicians in this country seems to be flat-footed to this Venezuela crisis. Many of them, as you say, have already jumped over and declared Guaido to be the de facto leader soon to be anointed. I wonder if you could provide any insight into the origin of this kind of very impoverished response to a crisis that is complex and requires contextual analysis. And one point I wanted to raise is the fact that the Democrats back in the past couple of years since Trump was elected jumped on this sort of new Cold War bandwagon, promoting the expansion of NATO, declaring Russia our mortal enemy, demonizing Putin to the level of a villain with superpowers, and basically pushing Trump to more provocative behavior toward Russia. Now, when the specter of Russian support for Venezuela, including military aid, is being parlayed here as a threat to our hemisphere, and similarly, when Russia during the actual Cold War supplied support to Cuba, there's this reflexive response on the part of Democratic politicians. They've made their bed with the neocons on this, and they don't seem to have any room to maneuver. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, yes, and in some cases they are worse in that they're trying to stop the few things that Trump is doing that are good, like trying to stop him from withdrawing troops from Syria or Afghanistan. We were just in the offices of 13 congresspeople who were all Democrats who signed on to a letter around Trump negotiating with the chairman of North Korea to say that we demand that you keep those provocative military exercises that we have traditionally done with South Korea, that you keep them going. There was also legislation to say you cannot remove U.S. troops from South Korea. So trying to stymie him on coming to a historic peace treaty with North Korea. In the case of Venezuela, the policy is really being led by Marco Rubio from Florida, and he is a total interventionist on this. And there is, unfortunately, not enough of a countervailing force on the grassroots level that is pushing enough Democrats. There was a letter that Congressman Ro Khanna put out that was a very mild letter saying that the economic sanctions are hurting ordinary Venezuelans and that we should also not be intervening. And so far, I think he's only got 10 members of Congress to sign on. There's another bill that perhaps will get more people because it starts out saying how horrific Maduro is, but then says that the president does not have the authorization to intervene militarily. And there are about 23 co-sponsors on that, and hopefully more will keep signing on. But that's such a tiny portion of the 535 elected officials we have on the national level who should be weighing in on this. And unfortunately, not just the Republicans, but a lot of the Democrats, including now Nancy Pelosi, are weighing in on the wrong side of this.
Medea, I wanted you to place in context this intervention that we're seeing unfold here in Venezuela. I've seen it for decades now, but it seems that oil, as in most of U.S. foreign policy, valuable resources are really the crux of what motivates U.S. foreign policy. And because Venezuela has the most proven oil reserves in the entire world, it's a valuable prize for a U.S. administration that would like to put Venezuela back in the U.S. orbit and have a way, as you describe in your recent article, have a way to get in and get a lot of the profits there for the taking from the Venezuelan oil industry.
Well, yes, and usually this is hidden, and we have to we assume it, but find out years afterwards when we can see some of the documents. We don't have to be scratching hard under the surface this time because it's right out in the open when Bolton says it would be good for the U.S. and Venezuela for the U.S. to be involved in the production of the oil, meaning take over the oil industry, which had been nationalized even before Chavez in the case of Venezuela. We also have Trump's saying in the case of Iraq, well, you know, if we went in there, we should have gone in and taken the oil. So this administration is very upfront about it, what it perceives as the economic interests of the United States. It's really the interests of big oil in the United States. But yes, it's impossible to discount the role that oil plays. Were it not for the massive reserves of oil that Venezuela has, the U.S. would not be interested in trying to overthrow the present regime.
Dee, I wanted to ask you if we were to speculate about what might happen if Guaido and his faction, which actually is a very splintered opposition, but if Guaido came to power, what kind of political and economic policies might we expect to take shape in Venezuela?
Well, there would be a massive privatization and a reversal of a lot of all of the programs, probably of the Bolivarian Revolution. On the other hand, there would not only be a lifting of the sanctions, but there would be a massive influx of money coming into Venezuela, which might certainly would make bring back the wealthy classes in Venezuela, and might also help the middle class and in general. Let's face it, something has to change in Venezuela. The economy is indeed not a viable one for the well-being of the Venezuelan people. But if you have the international community led by the United States that want to seal off Venezuelan government now from getting access to its own resources overseas, the only way to alleviate that in some ways become the very people who are helping to cause this problem. They become the saviors. I don't think that a Guaido government would be unified in any way. As you said, the opposition is extremely divided, but I do think we would see a massive influx of capital, which is very much lacking today.
Well, Medea, I would ask you as we conclude here to give our listeners the Code Pink website or any other website that you think would be helpful in sorting out the truth of what's going on in Venezuela, a story that we're not getting from our corporate media.
Well, yes, please go to our website, codepink.org. Not just to learn more about what's really happening, but to help us with the actions we're taking. We're having regular strategy meetings, including this weekend, next week. We're working with a coalition that continues to broaden out, and we need a lot of grassroots support for this. So please sign up for our newsletters and help us to reverse what is looking like a really dangerous, dangerous policy of the Trump administration to overthrow this government and perhaps lead us on the path to a war in Latin America.
Thank you. And I think the last word here might be that, given what you said about the fact that so few of our politicians, of our elected officials, have actually taken any position, not to mention the right one on this question, it is time for the type of citizen action that we were talking about earlier in the show. Get on the phones and demand that our elected representatives choose a path of peace, negotiation, and humanitarian resolution to this situation.
All right, Medea, thank you so much. We'll talk again soon, hopefully.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Great weekend. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Medea Benjamin, a longtime peace and social justice activist, organizer, and co-founder with Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. And you can read her article on Venezuela at commondreams.org. It's titled Venezuela, the U.S. 68th Regime Change Disaster.
So glad we had her on, because there has been a complete dearth of context provided in the conversations around Venezuela. Venezuela is just a little corollary to the madness that's been going on in the mainstream media with all the investigations, all the scandals in Virginia, the election hype that Ruth referred to is already starting. So Venezuela is kind of like, oh, well, you know, it's just another little Latin American bloodbath that we're going to just do as part of our basic portfolio.
Well, it's hard to get your head around, because so much of it, at least to those of us of a certain age, is deja vu. But the actors are not deja vu. Some of the actors, including the main actor we know, are unpredictable. And so you can't even begin to anticipate. You can't play mental chess to try to figure out what you would recommend or how to conceive of it. You have to think of playing mental chess with craps on the side or something. It's pretty terrible.
And it's consistent. The policy that we're seeing unfold with the Trump administration in Venezuela is pretty consistent in terms of, I think, the overall elite government consensus and among Democrats and Republicans, and particularly among Republicans when it comes to their view of the need to capture valuable resources out there through the use of sanctions, covert activity in the military. I mean, we saw that in Iraq, of course, and we're seeing it, as Medea said, it's a repeat of something we've seen over and over and over again in U.S. policy. So Trump's an outlier on a lot of stuff, but this is pretty consistent boilerplate GOP establishment consensus.
Just want to give out the phone number if anybody would like to give a call and express your opinion or ask a question. The number to call is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And you're listening to The Resistance Roundtable, which comes to you the second Saturday of each month here at WPKN. My name is Richard Hill, and the panel is here as usual, Scott Harris and Ruth Ann Baumgartner. You know, though I must say that you said Trump is an outlier on many issues, I see him pursuing a pretty neocon approach to foreign policy, with a few exceptions, as Medea pointed out, North Korea negotiations and his what seemed to be a very impulsive pronouncement about withdrawing troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. But basically, you know, he abrogated the Iran nuclear deal. He's prepared, or perhaps already has, agreed to send arms to Ukraine, something that the Obama administration demurred on, I should say. And he's withdrawn from the INF, which is another probably high on the list of neoconservative approaches to foreign policy. So when Mike Pence said, well, Donald Trump does, you know, he shies away from foreign involvement. But when it comes to Latin America, that's a bridge too far for him. He's got to get involved. Utterly disingenuous statement from Mike Pence.
Well, it feels as if, you know, whoever gets the right idea to really praise him up in the whole Venezuelan situation will probably get at least a temporary throwing in of Trump's weight on that side, because he doesn't read, he doesn't listen to advisors. He, as far as we can tell, he doesn't seem to deliberate. He doesn't ask for opinions. He just, somebody says something on TV or somebody tweets something, and there he goes. He, sometimes his foreign policy seems to be based on a movie that he saw the night before.
We have a caller on the line. Hi, WPKN, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Excellent show. I just tuned in. The piece that really concerns me, I mean, the whole thing is incredibly concerning, and I'm just startled beyond comprehension. The media is not following this at all, and if they do, it's just a little snippet, and that really annoys me. The thing that nobody's reporting on is that Elliot Abrams has been brought from the dead back into this situation as the special envoy. And he's about as destructive as a human being can possibly be in Latin America. And I know, Scott, you know a lot about this man. You've been following him over the years. And maybe you could just share your thoughts a little bit about this Elliot Abrams situation.
Yeah, thank you. Don't continue with your comments, or if you're done,
I've been watching what Colombia's been saying, and a little ways back when Trump started saying that the option, military option's on the table, the Colombian president was opposed to it. Now I'm watching to see what this man does. He's a young new president over there, and let's see how he caves. Okay, because he already came out saying he was opposed to it. And in fact, he even said most of the Latin American countries are opposed to it. But I'm seeing a change of wind. I don't know. Is it, you know, that John Bolton is twisting arms? You know, this thing is unfolding, and it's like, I don't know what to do. I mean, I want to do something.
Well, first thing would be to call your representative and your senators in Connecticut and get them, see if you can get them to...
I'm in New York.
Oh, you're in New York. Okay, well...
It works the same.
Same formula. One thing I should want to interject here is this idea that Bolton talked about the troika of tyranny, reminiscent of the axis of evil, which was invented, by the way, by David Frum back in the Bush 2 administration. In this case, it's Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela. And there's already grumblings about how Venezuela is the first domino to go, and then it will be Cuba and Nicaragua to follow. And if the United States manages to pull this off, look out below, because Cuba and Nicaragua will be directly in the line of fire.
Hmm. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you, and thanks for pointing that out. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I'll just say a quick word about Elliot Abrams. I think Medea covered it earlier, but in addition to being blood-soaked in the death squad, the U.S. support for the death squads under Reagan and H.W. Bush, the late H.W. Bush, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed as a result of U.S. support for death squads, mm-hmm. right-wing fascist death squads. I mean, there's no way around it. Elliot Abrams was the point person in that policy during those years. He's brought back. What can we expect? I mean, there's not a lot of guessing mm-hmm. there. The other thing is that Elliot Abrams was convicted of lying to Congress. He was pardoned by H.W. Bush on his way out, but he was convicted to lying to Congress. And here we are with a guy who's in a very powerful position now with this new crisis in Venezuela, a guy who's got no credibility on any level, whether moral or even just in terms of the actions he's taken while in government in previous years.
And a final word, I think, in terms of media coverage on this whole issue, is the fact that there's no conversation about the parallel here between the U.S. strategy in Venezuela, supporting opposition factions, trying to meddle with actually participate in coups in Venezuela, with the parallel to Chile in the early 70s, when a duly elected socialist government was basically sabotaged and ultimately overthrown through U.S. meddling. And you've been listening to the Resistance Roundtable. We come to you the second Saturday of each month here at WPKN. For Scott Harris, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, I am Richard Hill. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more great programming at WPKN. We'll see you soon.